Welcome to The Brains Behind It, the official podcast of BrainHackers.com. The source for smart strategies to improve your life, one brain hack at a time. In this podcast, we talk to the leaders and innovators behind great organizations and find out the secret to their success. Here's your host, editor-in-chief of BrainHackers.com, and two-time Guinness record holder for memory, Dave Farrow.
Hey there, Brain Hackers. Dave Farrow here with another Brains Behind It. We're talking about leadership here today. And the company actually is Exceptional Leaders Lab. And I'm talking today with Wally Schmader. He's partners with Tracy Spears in this laboratory where they uncover the truth of practical tools for leadership. It's actually some really cool stuff. Check it out after this. Hey, Wally, welcome to the show.
Hey, Dave. Nice to see you.
All right. So we were talking a little bit about leadership beforehand, and the idea is that there's a lot of people who talk about leadership. And I think that when I say that, I don't mean to diminish what you're doing. I just mean that I think that a lot of people jump onto that train. And I guess the cynical person out there might think, you know, not everybody can be a leader. You have to have some followers. But I understand that what you're talking about in terms of leadership, you can also see it as metaphorically like leading yourself. Like everybody has to be a leader to some extent. So what would you say to just how crowded this space is and how many people talk about leadership? How do you cut through that?
Yeah, that's a great point, and it's definitely true. We are saturated with leadership stuff. I'm not sure why. There's certainly more information out there about leadership than there are leaders, to your point. I think what you want to think about it is that everybody's a leader, right? In their life, they're leading, and they need to lead their families, need to lead their peers. There's bosses that need to be managed in some cases. So I think when you think in terms of personal leadership and taking a lead in your own life, it starts to take on more meaning for people. But I agree with you. There is a lot out there, and it's a little bit hard to filter through it sometimes and figure out exactly what's meant for you.
Well, you were doing leadership back when it was much less crowded space. I think like YouTube's a big responsible for that. A lot of people can pop up videos and things like that. But how long have you been doing this, and tell us what makes you different? You guys are more practical, right?
Yeah, I think where we came from, my partner's Tracy Spears, as you mentioned, and we came from corporate leadership roles for many, many years with big teams and, you know, bureaucratic org charts and all those things that you would imagine, and spun out of that with an idea of creating a business, a company that would be focused on extremely practical leadership, like only actionable things. And so whenever you read one of our books or go through one of our video courses or something, you're going to get stuff that you can go use later that day. There's no theory. There's nothing academic about it. We actually provide scripts and things like that that are totally practical for the user of either an aspirational leader, maybe a lower level manager, or even a lot of executive leaders. So I think our handle is usable, right?
Yeah, that's fantastic. And you're really hitting it all cylinders with me when you say it's not academic, as in it's not theory. I'm very much a big believer that there is a place for academia, but I think we need to balance it out with industry, with real world experience, practical. I think the theory and the practice should be 50-50, and very much it's usually, you know, 70-30 or something like that, right?
Yeah, I think that's about right. And if you could see to the right of me here, you'd see a few hundred leadership books, and you know, they're all great, and there's so much great content out there. But the experience a lot of, especially aspiring leaders have, is they'll read a book, or they'll see a YouTube video or a TED Talk or something, and they'll know more, but they won't be exactly sure how to implement or, you know, make that real in their day-to-day leadership responsibilities. So we're trying to build that bridge.
When the rubber meets the road, so to speak, huh?
Exactly, yeah.
So everyone's a leader, but isn't this partially, like, at least the interest from corporate is money, right? You want to make more money, you want to be more successful, you want to be more productive, right? So isn't this kind of just another way of saying, let's get people off their ass and working harder, or like taking some responsibility? Because basically what you want as an employee, if you're an employer out there, and if you want to know how to, you know, really raise your career, is you don't want the clock puncher. You don't want the person who they're at work, but they don't really care about what they do. You don't want somebody who doesn't care. Even if you're, you know, working in a warehouse packing boxes, you want somebody to actually, if I ran that warehouse, I'd want everybody to enjoy their job, to want to be there, you know, to some extent. Obviously you don't enjoy it as much as playing video games maybe, but to enjoy it as much as you can in your career, and to everyone should feel like, hey, this is a step to some other place that they want to go to. So is it kind of, is that just another way of talking about leadership, that you just want everyone to, you know, get off your ass, don't just like, you know, sit around and mope, and you're not just there to punch a clock, you're there for something deeper.
That's it. Yeah, I think that what you're talking about is engagement, and people that want to be engaged at work, people want to matter, right? They want to understand where they fit and what they're doing, how it affects the big numbers. And it's interesting that the profit motive in the C-suite is what's driving a lot of leadership training and leadership interest. There's no doubt about that. And it can make you feel a little bit cynical, but the truth is, even the thing, regardless of what motivates executives to teach and learn leadership, it all ends up in the same place, which is a good place where people are more engaged. That frontline worker understands how their hard work affects that bottom line or that performance or that KPI or whatever they're using to measure. And so engagement is the business we're in. And that's say, I matter because of this. I affect the profitability or success of this business because of these things. And if a leader hasn't done their job, that person just doesn't know what their connection to the success of that organization is. And that's all engagement, right?
And there's also, you use the word engagement. I use getting off your ass. So you're far more geared towards corporate than I am. I got to work on that.
You got to speak the language, right?
There you go. And I joke, but I do corporate work myself, and I get it. Yeah. But this is YouTube, so I can be plain. I hear what you're saying. This is also really important, I think. The lower down on the totem pole you get, this is not just for middle management or management, because this sort of thing of people owning their job, you know, to say, hey, this is my job, it's my responsibility. Even if you're leading the fry cooker, you are in charge of that. You're the leader of that, you know?
Right.
And when you feel like you're not even in control of yourself, that you're just like a trained Muppet and somebody is bossing you around, pushing you around because you've got a bad leadership above you, that's what leads to these feelings of inadequacy, of jealousy, of like, oh, that jerk, if that boss could work my job for 5 minutes, he'd be screwed. And like, oh, you know, and all this bitterness and all that stuff. That's if it's not taken care of, right? That's if you have bad leadership in an organization, right?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And there's a lot of tests for that. Like, you can think that same frontline worker, let's say that person who's dropping the fries and the oil, and that's their job, and they are punching the clock, right? They're barely alive when they first get to work. If they have and somewhere in a big corner office, there's a Lucite mission statement, right, that says something something very inspiring, right, that took all of 10 or 15 minutes to figure out with in front of a consultant some number of years ago. But if that thing makes sense to that fry cook, you've got engagement, right? If they can say, yeah, that's right, that's why I showed up today, I'm a part of this. That and the second piece, of course, which you know, is there has to be some sense of aspiration there, where if I do this really well and I show up on time every day, then I can go somewhere. There's a ladder that I'm on somewhere, and a good leadership also explains how those rungs above work, right? How you get to that next one. Some leaders are horrible at that, as you know.
And it depends on the organization too. You know, right. I mean, I when I was younger, I had all sorts of crappy jobs. I had I worked at McDonald's once, and I think my last job was Subway. That was the last job I had before I was running my own business full time. And I've certainly had a lot of bad jobs when it came to sales. I was a telemarketer for years and things like that. And the financial incentive was the only one there. And I think that we have a large segment of our population that is just bitter at the world because they're not really engaged. And I've also, you know, worked, I worked in a restaurant one time, and I've got a friend of mine who opened a new restaurant as well, that, you know, the person who's cooking, you know, in the back loves doing that. He's able to be creative. He comes up with some ideas. He's able to interact with people. He feels appreciated, like little things like this. So it's not really a function of how much you pay people, although money is important to some extent. But it is not the only thing. So what would be your prescription if you go into an organization and everybody is just, it's mismanaged, the bosses are just bossing people around and pushing people around instead of understanding them, and all the employees are feeling like just bitter and not appreciated and everything, how would you fix something like that?
So let me ask you a question. So you worked in fast food and in sales, right? Where you're going to find some of the worst. Those are probably the two industries or niches that have the worst management and leadership of all. So what were the differences between your good and bad managers? What did you notice when you were...
I found that Now, this might just be my personality, but I found that the micromanaging was bad, and I found that also it was a matter of micromanaging and controlling at the same time as not giving enough information. So okay. I felt like if I had the proper training, I've heard this complaint by a lot of people who are minimum wagers as well. If just explain it to me properly, just so I truly understand and everything, and then leave me alone. That would have been perfect. Where it was the opposite. I felt like it was never truly explained. I didn't really know what I was supposed to do. And then when I was trying to figure stuff out, then, you know, people would bark orders and stuff. Yeah. That would be my complaint.
Okay. So those, you just hit on the two biggest things, right? So one of them is a sense of transparency, right? That I know, what are we trying to do as a company? You know, are we opening offices, or am I at risk somehow here? What is my level of security in this
world? Or even like, what do I have to sweep now? Do I have to, you know what I mean? Like, what do I have to do? What do I not have to do? It was still, you know, unsure.
Yeah. Tell me what my job is. Tell me the expectations. And the other one is we talked about just how do I fit in all of this and recognize me for good work? You know, even this, maybe this isn't the most important job at Subway, but if I do this really well, it definitely affects the customer experience. And tell me that, you know, make sure that I understand that. So I think the good leaders and the good managers understand that leadership is a verb, right? It's something you do. It's an act. And I think especially at lower level in sales management, in some cases, certainly in fast food management, they imagine that the word manager or shift leader is just some authority that they can spend in the right and wrong ways, depending on who they are. But it's really something you do, right? It's coaching, it's recognition. There's a whole bunch to talk about there. And I'll go on for 1 second. We're seeing a social movement that you see where the millennial group, you know, this huge, now the largest employed group in America, is reacting to all the things you're saying. You're saying, hey, if you're not going to tell me I'm important, if you're not going to engage me and give me a view to how all this works, I'm not going to give you all of myself, right? Mm-hmm. You're only going to get the part of me that shows up between these hours. I'm not going to think about work when I leave. I'm not going to be here for 10 years. Right? I'm going to do other things at the same time. So they're pulling a few chips off the table, right? And I think it's reacting to a lot of poor leadership.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I would also say that as a small business owner who we could not pay staff what they deserve for a long time, even to this day, I think that, you know, we've got some raises planned and we're approaching where I feel comfortable, where I want them all to be making six figures, to be honest. But but in the beginning, certainly we couldn't pay nearly competitive wages, but I gave other perks: flexibility of time, flexibility of energy, of control over your own domain, not micromanaging responsibility. And I got to say, I have people who are working for less than other people pay, you know, or they're paid more now. Just be sure. But they were staying late and arriving early. They were working extra hours. They were anything to get the job done, to get the customer happy. Yes. And that's the exact opposite of what I used to, you know, see when I was employed. So that's something I took pride in.
So that's, you are a case study, right? That's it. So think about the things you just said there. You said, I sat him down. I said, hey, I know I'm not paying you what you're worth. I know that. I mean, imagine how important that would be for someone to hear, because they certainly don't want to think they're worth, you know, only what you're paying them. And then you painted a picture, say, we're not going to stay where we are now. We're growing. And you'll be part of that success. You'll be part of that. You'll benefit from that success. Mm-hmm. And PS, once I get a chance to pay you what you are worth, I will. Right. So that's just all those things. That's exactly. And so that person's not going to go anywhere.
Yeah. Why and we've had, as a result, over the last few years, we've had revenues double twice. And they've gotten scheduled raises, and we've got some more planned as well. So, and I want to make sure that, I mean, I pay them before I pay the tax. Like they're the most important thing, you know?
Yeah. Well, congratulations.
Government probably doesn't want to hear that.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a thing that in some of our leadership clients, and certainly in the books, we're talking a lot about the three big mega trends for leaders. And one of them, there's three, and one of them is that culture is the new compensation. Okay. So there's really not that much difference what someone's going to make here versus there in a certain role. Right. And a lot of that's commoditized. So we're going to pay people, and they're going to benefit from a great culture. And what you're describing is that it's a competitive advantage. Someone will hang around there where they wouldn't go somewhere else, or maybe they make a dollar more somewhere else, but they're not going because of the culture. So it's a big deal.
Yeah. Yeah. No. I've had people, you know, get setbacks and everything. And then they say, no, I'm still going to stick around because I love the people I work with, and I like the work that we're doing, and I feel like it's appreciated, you know?
Yeah. Big deal. Yeah. It's huge.
Absolutely. Okay. So, going forward, how do you, market this business of yours. So like we're going to do a little switch here. Like this is, not only are you an expert at this, but you sell your expertise. So how do you sell information? How do you monetize that sort of business? A lot of people are curious who are experts in their field.
Yeah, well, our track or arc is a lot like a lot of businesses that start up in the leadership space. And then as you try to figure out, you get passionate about something, you get good at something if you can, and then you figure out how to get that outreach as wide as you possibly can. So we do a few things. One is Tracy Spears is a well-known worldwide keynote speaker, and she speaks in front of large corporations and organizations all the time. So that's one, but that's not really scalable, right? That's a person standing in front of a room, right? And that's hard to scale.
But I think that's really important in the early days too. Like, and I'm not saying you're in the early days, but it's just like, I think that's really important. And I would also say, actually, at every stage, the new trend today for CEOs is the chief salesperson. You know, if you think of a CEO of Apple gets up on stage and they're the first person that talks about anything when there's ever, you know, product being launched. So I think that's always going to be an essential skill.
Absolutely. And it's a brand builder, and she's somewhere right now in front of a big group doing something. So I'm on the development side. I work a lot on the books. We've had 3 books now. The last one, last year, it was from 2016, but last year it was a number one bestseller on Amazon, What Exceptional Leaders Know.
Congratulations.
In our category. We're not up there with Harry Potter or anything, but in the leadership space.
And then we just had still pretty impressive.
Yeah, well, thank you.
Because in that leadership space, you got people like Simon Sinek. You've got like a lot of, you know, very well-publicized people
with
large followings, and you've grown a quite a good following.
In leadership, it's strange versus other nonfiction areas. The best-selling books are always the classics. It's How to Make Friends and Influence People. Yeah. It's The 7 Habits. Those are always the ones that's what you're up against.
Is Think and Grow Rich a leadership book, I think?
It's in the category, yeah. So that's a great example of one that's just up there. It's number 3 perpetually, right? Because it has to be part of what everybody does. Yeah, so the book, we have a new book this year called Exceptional Leaders Playbook, and it's doing really well. We're excited about that. And then we just released a video series, and this is us trying to do what you're doing, which is push something out there that's digital and easy to access for people. And it's got 4 hours of content, and when someone registers, they have a whole year to spend with all of the content, so there's no rush. So that's our latest thing to try to push that outreach a little bit more.
I found that as well, that as somebody who sells information myself, you know, you have to have different price points, and you know, your book is your onboarding tool. I actually avoided writing books for a long time because I wanted people to buy my kit. You know, this was you know, when CDs and DVDs were very popular. Now it's a totally different kind of arc, if you will. I have a 6 DVD program or 4 CD program, and it was like a little kit that you get, and that led to an infomercial and millions in sales. But at the end of the day, though, it was it's like a $200 package typically as an average sale. So I always tell people when I was doing interviews, I only have to interest 5 people in this interview. And then like for that hour, I made $1,000 in sales. Like that's worth my time.
Sure.
Whereas when you're selling books, you know, you interest 5 people, maybe you've made $50. So like the financial side of it doesn't work out. But what you can do is if you get enough, but in today's day and age, it's kind of flip-flop where if you get a lot of people buying your book, then you can lead them to your course and your online material because that's a more convenient, easier, and readily accessible format to get the information. It's more actionable.
No doubt. And it took us a while to learn that. We thought that the book would be the thing, especially if it sold a lot. But really, that is the gateway to a deeper relationship, hopefully. And we end up with corporate engagements and executive coaching relationships out of that. But the book, I think, for us was a necessary piece just to have something, like you said, that's entry level to be a handshake with a new customer or someone we haven't worked with before. So it worked for us.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And just like along the same lines, we've had the brainhackers.com up for nearly a year now. We've had Brains Behind It for about a year. And now we'll be releasing the top 50 brain hacks as a book, you know?
Nice.
So like that sort of thing, compile some stuff together and make it happen. We'll have a best of this series as well. Things like that.
When's the book come out?
We don't have a specific date for it, but it'll probably be 2019. You know, it'll be edited and formatted and everything, but it'll probably be like the best times to really launch a book. Just in case anybody's curious, PR wise, typically I really recommend September or February. You know, September or January, February, basically, because those tend to be the times, especially for a self-help or a personal development type book. Those tend to be the times that people are most interested in proving themselves. Now, there are exceptions, you know, sometimes different things do better in the fall, educational stuff, you know, sometimes relationship stuff. Summertime can be really good for other types of, you know, like, Eat, Pray, Love, you know, was more of a summertime book. Like there are some that, that have that feel. Yeah. So it really does depend on the topic, but I'd say all things being equal, you probably get like a 10% boost if you do at the beginning of the year or at the beginning of September, because people see that as two times the year that, that things start.
Right. You know? Yeah. Ours was late January. And I think you're right that nonfiction, okay, professional, personal development stuff, people seem to be thinking more about it at the end of and the beginning of New Year's.
That's the same reason, you know, you go to a gym in January and see how busy it is. You know, people set their goals, and by February it's ghost town.
Yeah. We hope they finish the book by then. That's the whole goal.
Well, I think that, and I mean, we're cynical about people who set goals, because most people fail in their goals. But I think that, you know, if you look over the course of a whole person's life, there's usually, they'll try a goal and then they'll abandon it. Well, maybe that wasn't for them anyway. You know what I mean? That, like, so there'll be something, if they keep on trying, they're going to find something that they stick with. So it's a good strategy. I don't want to be cynical about setting goals in general, but yeah, it tends to be like the mass moves in at certain times, you know, and then you capture some of them permanently, and then the rest kind of move on. Maybe.
Exactly. So you want to hear a tactic that we use for teaching goal setting to people that have failed it. So most people get intimidated by goal setting, as you said, that failed in the past. It's a big word, right? Goal. And so when we do workshops, the way that we can engage people that haven't succeeded at it is we call it the December 31st question. And all we're saying is, Dave, let's fast forward. It's December 31st, Tuesday, December 31st, New Year's Eve, right, of 2018. What would have made it a great year? What would have made it a great year? And have them look backwards instead of forwards. And it's weird. I could ask somebody, tell me your goals for 2018. They wouldn't be able to think of anything.
Nothing.
But if I tell them what would have made it a great year, typically they spit out a few really inspiring things, right? Things that even get me excited about what they're trying to do. So for some reason, that seems to engage. Just for those of you that haven't had much success with goals, maybe think about that. Yeah.
Well, actually, that actually corresponds to a principle of the brain that we use in memory techniques. That is that what you visualize on some level you think is actually happening. It's actually real, right? Okay. So if I'm visualizing the future, that's a nebulous thing. I can't imagine that, right? But if I put myself in a future time looking back, then all of a sudden it's more concrete. It's a real thing. This has already happened. So my brain will be much, much more ready to jump into that thought experiment. You know, I did something similar to that in our goal setting workshop. I called it destination setting. That's trademark. But basically, the idea was that a goal is you're aiming and hoping, you know, but a destination was what I kind of use the analogy of a pilot, how a pilot decides where they're going. You know, we're not hoping to reach Chicago Airport. We're going to reach Chicago Airport, and you have a specific time that you're going to do it.
You're plotting the way, right?
Yeah, but a pilot mentally puts themselves there and then works backwards. How much distance, how much fuel will I need, all the way back to where's my cue, when do I leave, make sure all the you know all the people are sitting in their chairs, and all the last minute checks before you take off. You don't get into the air before you do that working backwards. You don't get into the air and then choose where you're aiming, which is kind of a goal setting idea.
That's a great metaphor.
Yeah. And actually, I found out later on that Harvard does it for some of their business planning. When I was teaching at some companies, they said this is similar to how Harvard does their business planning, where they pick the ideal business and then work backwards. How are we going to get there? So
that makes sense.
Know, it's interesting. Yeah. I mean, you know, truth is truth, right? It kind of changes the flowers, but the roots stay the same. Great.
So we've got a module that we've been delivering with private clients, not in the book or in the videos yet, but I wanted to ask you about it since it's in your sweet spot.
Cool.
And it is that focus is the new IQ, right? We're so saturated with content. Everybody's got all the information they want via the internet, right? So no one's going to lack for information about anything. So the ability to narrow down and deep focus on a task or an idea or a challenge is going to be the differentiator between leaders, but probably between everybody. So what's your take on that? Focus is the new IQ.
You know, I would say that's very accurate, because IQ is defined as your ability to solve problems. But there's been a kind of, I don't know, dirty little secret amongst the whole Mensa world or genius world, right? There's a lot of people who can score very high on an IQ test, but they don't really succeed in business. they have an ordinary job, you know, and not that, you know, you can't be a school teacher, you can be a postal worker, something like that. You know, some of these people can be in Mensa, and it seems like there doesn't seem to be any more rhyme or reason. It doesn't seem to really equate to success, you know, financially, at least, right?
Right.
Not putting anyone down. You know, my dad was a factory worker. My mom was a homemaker. I don't think I'm better than anybody, but it's just, if you're judging by money, intelligence didn't always seem to be the exact measure. But, right. You know, people looked at geniuses like Einstein, and certainly has very, very high IQ, but it was also the sheer amount of perspiration and focus he put into the task to actually solve the problem. You look at like a Tesla, like, you know, Wozniak, you look at like some of the people who Dyson today too, and things like that. You know, they often say genius is inspiration and perspiration, but I think that focuses the new IQ is a really good way to say it, because sometimes a problem, in order to solve it, you have to focus on it so intently until it gives up. You have to be stronger than it.
Right. Yeah, and a lot of the smartest people we meet, right, can't manage their thoughts at all. They know everything about everything, but never, you know, a mile wide and an inch deep, they can't get down to something and actually build it out or develop it.
Now, I would say that's a different issue, though, because focus versus specialization, you know, focus on a problem, but sometimes having a diverse knowledge base can give you options. There's actually a lot of work being done in cross-curricular activities. You know, yeah. So people in, you know, masters of business, also having a minor in computer programming, and then combining those two together, coming up with brand new things, you know, people are combining computer programming with genetic engineering and things like that.
Yeah.
And so sometimes like a wide base of knowledge would be good, but the individual being able to focus on task and not give up, not lose motivation, that's one of the bigger judgments of whether or not someone's going to be high performance.
Right. Yeah, for sure. And how in intelligence and distractibility for a lot of people go hand in hand, and there's more things there, you know, just the tabs on our browser, right, can keep us from getting work done sometimes when there's something that small. So it's interesting.
Yeah. Well, in my background, I was diagnosed with ADHD when I was 14, and I learned and improved on these memory techniques to counteract that. But it was a real thing. I was very, very distractible, and I knew that was a problem. So I developed a technique that allows me to focus in short chunks on a task and then switch tasks. And I actually have a timer. The timer goes off, and I can stop focusing and switch tasks. And that's what enabled me to get my Guinness record. I focused on one deck at a time when I was memorizing it. I could show you how to memorize one deck of cards, but I was able to train myself to the point where I was flawless, nearly flawless throughout the whole thing. And that's what allowed me to get to such a high degree of accuracy. That personal performance, I think focus is more important than intelligence, or at least as important, absolutely.
Just because we have access to all the information now, right?
So, yeah, well, there's something called the Google effect, where it says that the people, we know for a fact that people's memories are worse than they were, say, in the 80s or 90s, and it's largely because of smartphones like this. We're better at searching for information, we're worse at holding on to information. So being able to search fast and do research, I think, you know, part of it is because the demands of the workplace have changed. And focus on task is probably even more important than figuring it out yourself. Because some of you, like you said, maybe somebody's already figured it out, and it's just a matter of finding that solution.
Right. Yeah, which is why people like you and me exist, is to make sure that content is there and is accessible, right, by people who may need it and be able to benefit from it.
Yeah, it makes sense. And also in today's day and age with the internet, I mean, one of the best metaphors I ever heard that of information on the internet is that it's more akin, it's not a filing system, it's more akin to a fire hose of information just coming at you.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so I think partially it's how society has changed, where it's just this ton of information you have to deal with. You don't have a choice, you have to kind of sift through it. And the person who can focus on the key points that are most important to them and most important to the task at hand, they're king, absolutely.
No doubt. Yep. And it squeezes a lot of risk out of important projects, like people who want to get things done. They want to write a book, right? They want to do something new in their life, and they just can't get their sleeves rolled up for long enough to focus down on this very important thing. So all this time passes, the thing's not done. And, you know, the net for a lot of people is regret, because they weren't able to ever get down to that focus point. So It's important.
Yeah, I find that if you try to avoid regret in life, you're actually going to be pretty good. Like if you start thinking to yourself, oh, you know, am I going to regret this? Because first of all, it helps you not make terrible decisions, like going to jail or something.
Right.
But more importantly, the number one thing that people regret is not trying something. So if you focus, right. I've found that I've tried a lot of things, I've said yes to a lot of things. I'm very happy that I did, mainly because I thought, oh, you know, if I don't try this, I'm probably not going to get this opportunity again.
Right.
The quote unquote opportunity cost was too high for me. And most people don't think of that, you know?
Yeah. Well, you said, I mean, that's a very important point, right? That most people, and it's said by a lot of people in a lot of places, that the what gets regretted most is the stuff not done, not mistakes made for things you did do. It's that thing you never did that you could ever might have. I agree with that.
Well, yeah, I love talking to leadership people because we get, you know, very deep discussions like this. So I've really enjoyed this. So why don't you tell people where they can get a hold of you?
Yeah, so I would suggest everybody to register at exceptionalleaderslab.com. That'll get you in our little list, and that way you can get free stuff. We send out a lot of blogs and newsletters. Every once in a while, we'll choose a bunch of people to pilot a new program for us, which is a great way for us to work together. That'll give you access to these courses and books and things. So that's probably a good starting place. And the new book is Exceptional Leaders Playbook. If you want to check that out, you can get that on the site as well.
Awesome.
So, yeah.
Well, thank you very much. You're definitely a brains behind it. Appreciate it. And say hello to Tracy for me.
Will do. Thank you, Dave. Appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you for listening to The Brains Behind It. And remember to check out brainhackers.com for more. If you have a suggestion for the next interview or comment, please email editor@brainhackers.com. If you want a free 30-minute marketing consultation from Dave Farrow and his team, then email editor@brainhackers.com.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.